Yes, it is. Oh, good evening, everybody. Today is, let's get this right, Term 3, Session 4. Is that correct? Term 3, Session 4?
Yeah.
It is so good to see you all here. It's, almost everyone told me they couldn't make it this week. So we're going to have a very intimate, kind of cosy session. But what I'd like to do during this intimate, cosy session is give a bit of overall look at where we are in the book. We're actually really, really, really far in. This book is comprised of four sections. Four separate sections. Four volumes within this little book. This little book is like the Chumash. It's like the Bible of Jewish philosophy. It's all in here. And it's in four sections. The first section is called Fundamentals. And that deals with the creator, the purpose of creation, man, human responsibility in the spiritual realm. The second section, which I think is the toughest, is called Providence. And that deals with how God actually gets stuff done. How he interfaces with stuff, good and bad, how good people could possibly suffer, etc. All that business, how he basically interfaces with the universe. That's section two. And that's to do with providence, man in this world, individual providence versus global or general providence, which we'll get to. Israel and the nations, how providence works, the system of providence, the stars, astrology, the details of all that. That's section two. We are in section one. But where are we in section one? We're almost there. At the moment, we're holding by page 79. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're going to 83.
No. Did we?
I have.
You have. You have gone to 83.
I've got highlights.
Yeah, that's because we cross-referenced. We cross-referenced forward and backwards in the safer, so you may have highlighted stuff ahead.
I've got a note. False, good and bad.
That's a note that I would have given earlier. Is anyone else on page 83? Are we?
Yes, I'm on.
Are you on 83 as well?
Yes.
Good. I'm not going mad.
Sorry, are we on 83? I do apologise. Are we on 83? Are we on 83? Leslie, do you know where we are, Leslie? Does anyone else know? Do you know where we are? Oh yeah, my goodness, that's going to make a huge difference.
Here at the top. You only did the top bit, the first paragraphs there, at the top.
Right. So we're point six of page 83.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, we're at point six. Erica, do you concur with that?
I might say point seven.
It's too much for me. I'm going back to point six.
Notes on seven.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Look at this. The whole thing ends on page 87. It's only two more English pages, and then you'll have a blank page, which is where I put all my notes, my little hand notes thingsies. And that's the beginning of part two, which is Providence. So what we're going to hopefully do tonight is completely polish off the first chelik of Derech Hashem and just put it in the bag, which is huge. It's the most complicated, most abstract. It's the one that people find most difficult. It's the one people sometimes skip. They skip this bit and jump straight into two, which is like almost impossible if you learn it through. Because they're scared of it. This is it. So we're on page 83.6. Okay? Woo! Let's get to any questions on what we did last week to just make sure that we're all up to speed on what we're at. Last week we were talking about top down and bottom up. That's determinism versus indeterminism. Determinism is, I've got my magic picture here which I've now given out to you, finally. Determinism, if you look at the structure of the four worlds of Atzilus, Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya, these are the four very mystical Kabbalistic worlds. Determinism is top-down flow. It's God wants Bob the Mallard to migrate. God gets Bob the Mallard to migrate via deterministic influences. Is that clear to everyone so far? Indeterminism is bottom-up. It's where Jim makes free will decisions either in line or out of line with his divine directives. Will he chop down that cherry tree to make a coffee table for his wife, who keeps nagging him? Or will he be strong and have the resolve to say, no, I'll have to get you something else from IKEA? Okay? Bob the Mallard doesn't make indeterministic influences happen. Bob the Mallard's a program. Bob the Mallard is part of nature. Bob the Mallard is something God exacts his providence onto. Jim also has providence exacted onto him, but Jim can make decisions that are completely free, as it were, within the parameters of what he has ahead of him, that are outside of, as it were, God's intense overall general providence. General providence for these terms are, for the tape, environmental, genetic, and horoscopic factors. I'll say that one more time. General providence is environmental, horoscopic, and genetic factors. Outside of that is, I fancy eating a pork sandwich. Which is just my free will telling me, yeah, I know it's wrong, but I just want to try it, right? What about the whole thing that God said don't do? Yeah, I know about the whole thing, but you know what? Oh, okay, so what? That's not something ducks do. Ducks don't stop being ducks and pretend to be cats for a week just because they want to try it out and go against their program. Humans do. Humans do make decisions and change their life. Midstream, they can do stuff. That's the concept of top-down determinism, bottom-up indeterministic influences or indeterminism. And both of them have to exist, and the system has to be robust enough to take input without breaking, and still be able then to respond to those inputs with new deterministic flows that are in line with the decisions you make. Now you chop down the cherry tree, what about the birds that were living in the cherry tree? There was a nest of birds, all very happy pigeons just living there, just minding their own business, frankly. Now along comes gin, chops down the tree, which is not meant to do anyway, it's a fruit-bearing tree. Chops down, chop, 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 chop. In order to make a coffee table, the birds now have to be organised by the kaichus to be able to say, well, there is no tree there for you to be in. You'll have to find another tree to be in, and they'll have to literally be reassigned place in the world. But Jim is a free agent to do that. God gave Jim the ability to say, I know I could muck things up. I know I could do that, but I'm going to do it anyway. So Jim is, as it were, free to do what he wants. And God is, as it were, free to do what he wants. I'm not saying choosing between good and evil, because that doesn't apply to God. But he's free to do what he wants, and Jim's free to do what he wants. Ronnie.
That must be limited. Because, for example...
Sorry, what must be limited?
The last bit you're saying about Jim and his free will.
Yes.
And
obviously,
messing things up.
Limited to an extent.
For example, you've got the overall great plan, and within the bounds of the plan, so we know, for example, that the Holocaust...
Whoa.
Can't understand it.
Stop. Section 2 will talk about a cap to what man can and can't do. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking now about the general flow of determinism versus indeterminism. Do you understand the general concept of top-down versus bottom-up? Is that at least clear?
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Yeah, I was just thinking if somebody would have killed Hitler.
I'm talking generals, okay? Do you understand the general concept of how this works, top-down, bottom-up, okay? Jim is an archetypal human being with choice. We're not talking about specifics about Hitler or Stalin. And Bob is an archetypal animal which is acted upon in the system of nature. Is that in and of itself clear before we get into Pratim? Pratim is section 2, which I find the hardest, okay? Is everyone clear so far? Good to see you, people. Hi, Jack. How are you doing? You're right. Okay. Oh, we got all that done. I forgot to bring my mezuzah. I had a mezuzah to show you. Okay, doesn't matter. We utilised the concept... Sorry? No, a roll. I've got a roll. I had a mezuzah taken off. I need to get it checked. And I have the actual loose clap. And I wanted to show you something about the rolling of the mezuzah, about the way that the letters are spaced out and where you put letters on the other side versus the letters on the other. I don't have it in front of me, so there's nothing I can do. And I'm not going to start unscrewing the mezuzahs of the... you wouldn't have one here, because it's a base of medrash, right? So you don't have one of the base of kinesis, I assume. So, okay, so here we go. So we utilised this picture of a nerve, and we talked about, we used a parallel of the nerve being the kaichas, and the impulses being the malachim. The impulse is being the angelic messenger. What does malach mean? Messenger. Is everyone okay with that so far? So the system is layered in itself. Okay? Is everyone clear with those concepts so far before we continue? Yes. Fantastic. Lovely to see you. We're page 83, apparently. Even though I thought we were page 79 or something. And we're on 0.6, even though someone says we're on 0.7. I'm going to roll back to 0.6 because I feel just unbelievable that we're this far in. And we're about to finish, hopefully, section 1. The whole first Chelik of Hashem. Every indeterministic influence, indeterministic is bottom up, Who makes indeterministic influences? Only man. Not even God, not animals, nothing. Only man makes choices which go back up to the system. Remember, in our nervous system, has anyone got a sharp, pointy pen thing? Sharp, pointy pen. Is that very, very sharp? Okay, there we go. I've got a sharp point. Is that recorded? How would you know?
I presume it is because it came up before, so...
Good. Well, let's just leave it then. Right, let's talk about sharp, pointy pen. So let's say the sharp, pointy pen is on this table. And I want to pick up the sharp, pointy pen. How? Do you remember last time I kind of like had a paralysed arm and I didn't know what to do with my arm and you were going, move your arm, and I don't know how. So how do I move my arm? This is how it works, people. Okay, this is pretty awesome. A thought arises in my cerebral cortex, which is the higher part of my brain. And it says, pick up a pen. In language. So I go, oh, cool, I'm going to pick up a pen, and I can see a pen. So I innervate, my thoughts go around through my brain. They make all kinds of nervous things, synaptic, cleft, open, off. So we did just shut all the windows before we came. Just open up the windows again. Would you like the windows open? We did have all these synaptic clefts, all these nervous systems are going in the brain. And then finally, we'll get down to the brainstem. And the brainstem's the junction point. We're going to learn mystically what's going on with the brainstem and everything. The brainstem is the junction point of, it's actually mystically called the conduit of the mind. Oh, I'll give it to you. There we go. The brainstem and the spinal column is called the conduit of the mind. Because the mind, which is this kind of ethereal concept, is channeled down through the nervous system into the nerves. So the fact that I want to pick up a pen, part of my mind has been channeled down through my arm, right? That's true, right? So the nervous system is called the conduit of the mind. So up goes my arm. My arm has nerves in with impulses that are going, and they're making these muscles contract, which is lifting my arm. And finally, I pick up this pen. Everyone good with me so far? What direction of flow is this?
Downwards.
It's top down. This is determinism. If my mind, as it were, is God's mind, saying, I want to pick up a pen, the entire system has to be manufactured in order for me to be able to lift this pen. I have to have a brain, I have to have blood vessels, I have to have muscles, I have to have a neurological system, I have to have everything working for me to pick up this pen. But this is a sharp, pointy pen. Look what can happen when I pick up this pen. Ow! 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 Know what I mean? Now, what's going on there? A sharp, pointy thing pricked my finger. Now, what's going on? What's the response? That's an indeterministic response. So there is coming from the other end that is outside the system. I'm the system. I'm this entire system, right? And outside the system is Jim at the bottom wanting a pork sandwich. And he has the ability to send data up through the same system which it's being sent down back into my brain, which is going, sharp, pointy thing, hurting my finger. Move arm away. Save your arm, kind of thing. So you go, whoa, bring around, you know what I mean? So those nerves are coming back up my arm, telling my brain something is hurting my finger, and my whole body now is reacting in kind to the damage. Does that make sense? That's exactly what's going on in the universe. According to Jewish philosophy. Exactly what's going on in the universe. When man does a mitzvah and a veira, these are, thank you very, very much. Thank you. When a man does a mitzvah or an aveira, or a woman, obviously I'm talking mankind, what that's doing is basically putting stuff back in the system up the same channels that the system came down to you with. Does that make absolute sense? Because the nerves which allow me to pick up the pen are the same nerves which carry back the pain reception to my brain. Ooh, that's pretty sharp. Move your hand away. Do you see what I'm saying? But it isn't the nerves that did it. The nerves are just the koichas. The nerves are just the train tracks. It was the malachim who the train carriage going up to my brain. They come and go, whoa, there's something really sharp. We're coming in with new information. Brain's going, okay, that means there's something sharp, which could be a danger. So I'm not going to rescind. I'm going to pull my hand away to save myself from danger. So too, the koichas, the malachim, and everything like that change in flux based upon what's coming in from below. The whole system's designed in the same way that it comes down, it goes up. It's the same systems. You okay with that? Back in the text. So every indeterministic influence, and indeterministic would be the pricking of my finger in that particular thing, also results, listen to this, in deterministic influences. Pulling my hand away is deterministic as a response to it getting injured by a sharp pointy thing. Does that make sense? Do you see how that one sentence makes sense now? When the highest forces, the koichos, are influenced by man's free will and indeterministic bottom-up stimulus, they in turn influence the physical things that are inherently linked to them. Trees, fingers, lakes, whatever it is that you're involved in. Bigs, whatever. All these processes, however, follow many detailed laws as decreed by the highest wisdom as being best for creation. Just like the nervous system follows many detailed laws as decreed by the creator for your nervous system. How fast the electricity will go back and forth. How quickly the energy will recoup in the neurolemma, in the sheath around each nerve. Both the ways through which man's influence reaches the highest forces and the manner in which these forces react towards the physical world all depend upon many factors. It's a general concept. But all this concept, all those ideas, constitutes the deep mystery of how God's providence works and brings about everything that was and will be. How the body moves around of the universe, as it were, how this whole system interacts, is what we call providence. We're going to get to providence in such in-depth in section 2. We're going to go every nut and bolt that you could throw about it. But that's the general idea. Now we're on point 7. Is everyone okay to carry on point 7?
Are we saying, therefore, that a reflex reaction is the simulation?
Yes, that's exactly what we're saying. We're saying that reflexes... Well, no, they're a response to... No, they're a form of deterministic response, which is pre-programmed. Just to be really slick for you. If you really want to get into it. Instead of a decision being made, an automatic safety valve is put in place... For the question, probably people in tape land are going, what did he say? The question was, are reflexes a deterministic response? The answer is, yes, they are, to an indeterministic stimulus. So when you cross your legs and tap your knee and your leg just kicks out like that, that's God's setting up that it goes through the spinal column rather than through the mind. A decision wasn't made that I should kick my leg. It's best for you that you should kick your leg to protect the patella. And that's part of the system. That's part of the system. So you can do something which will... I told you last time, chores, right? Spiritual excision. Spiritual excommunication. Cutting off. Is a natural outcome of sucking the blood out of an animal's throat which has just had shechita performed on it. That's a reflex. Because as you suck the blood into your body, heaven forbid, the soul elements of that cow, whatever it is now being merged with you. And your higher degree neshama, let me just get the relevant picture. The animal only has a nefesh bahamis. And your higher degree neshama cannot bear to be bound with the animalistic soul of a bovine. So it just naturally, out of a reflex, recoils in disgust. You go, ugh! That is called chores. It's a system that God's telling you about. He's telling you not to do it. I met Rabbi Israel Tauber. Rabbi Israel Tauber told me, he said, many from people think God's the bogeyman hiding under the stairs. They think God's the bogeyman. So, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. You did that, I'm going to get you. It's not like that at all. He's telling you, this is how I've made the universe. Fire burns things. Cold makes things cold. Do this, if you want to cook food, put it on a fire. If you want to keep things cold, put it in the fridge. This is if he's trying to get you. He's just telling you this is the system. Avoid the bad things, do the good things. Don't drink from an animal's neck as it speaks. Because if you do, the response to that will be chores. It's spiritual excision. I'm telling you how the world is programmed, so don't do it. It's a system. Really, the righteous and the wicked reward themselves. By doing good things, or by doing bad things, they actually make a reality which they can't escape. That's the system. Put your hand in the flame, you get burnt. Okay. Point 7. As discussed earlier, God's wisdom decreed that both good and evil exist in the world. And last time we asked, I think it was Anthony, why do we need evil? to act as a contrast. He had to put evil in the mix. There was no other way around. Otherwise, he couldn't tell us not to eat pork unless he created pigs and the taste of pigs, etc., etc. Like all other things, these concepts must begin among the fundamental forces. They've got to be in the nerves. They've got to be all the way up in Eilam Habria, in the Kaichas. They've got to be in Kachot. They've got to be for the Sephardi contingent. They've got to be all the way up in the third world up, because that's where they have to be encoded, right? And then have effects in the physical world. It's got to work like that. Evil goes up to there and no further. Goes no further than the Kaichas. Beyond that, there's no evil. It's got to do what it does and no more. God's wisdom arranged the transcendental forces, these kaichas, these as the roots of all that was created, like the nervous system, and then set them in an order and system in which it would be possible that there should pertain to them either rectification, tikkun, or spiritual damage, kilkul. Now remember last time I told you about the Boston Rebbe, and the Boston Rebbe was asked, what do you do for a living? And he said, he's a plumber. Remember that? And we said, what's that got to do with it? How can you say a Rebbe of a Hasidic sect is a plumber? The answer was yes, because there are, as it were, pipes in creation. And we talked about Mazal Ra versus Mazal Tov. And we talked about how flow is meant to come down in a good way. And if you muck it up, known as kilkul, spiritual damage, a kink, as it were, in the tube, you get a plumber with all those snake things that goes in, he goes, oh, it cost you 50 quid, be ready Friday. And it goes, and it kind of cleans out all the muck in the pipes. And then the water can flow properly. That's exactly what a brocha from a tzaddik accomplishes. I.e., if you've put like athronymous plaques on the inside of a lumen of a tube, basically the whole inside of a tube gets all mucked up. You blow it away, as it were. That's the power of a brocha, as it were. We'll talk about that in section 3. The idea is that what's coming through the tubes just come through well anyway. You've got the tubes there anyway. The tubes are ready. You're not really involved in anything except for making a decision. Everything else you do, including the moving of your body, your respiration, is all done for you. You're not doing that. You're not actively involved in doing anything but choosing and experiencing things. That's all we do. Okay, so carrying on. This is really, really important. They therefore have states that are good and otherwise. What he means is evil. It's like this. If you muck up the koichas, you'll have nerve damage. There are certain deeds which are so destructive, you can actually damage the nerves of creation. Are you okay? Are you okay? Do you need anything? Okay, do you want a drink? Do you have a question? No? Sorry, you must have moved the wrong way and I must have interpreted that as you somehow weren't completely happy about something. If the koichas are the nerves and you damage them, you'll result nerve damage as they go all the way down. Remember, the malachim, the angels, are only the nervous impulses that go up and down the nerves. They have to have good train tracks to work on. The nerve's going to be there, right? And it's this way. And the electric impulses go up and down. But if you sever the nerve, or cut the nerve, or degenerate the nerve, you can put all the malachim back and forth, all the electricity back and forth, the wire, nothing's going to happen because the nerve is broken. God is telling you the outcome of man's deeds affects the nervous system. Not the malachim. It's the nervous system you actually affect. Ducks, don't do this. Cows, on the side of the road, there's cars there. They don't affect the koichas. We affect the koichas. The choices we make either strengthens the nervous system or breaks the nervous system itself. Which means that the negativity that's the outcome of that is your fault. And it's just a natural outcome of the whole system. What an amazing idea. You do a mitzvah, you're strengthening the nerve. God has left this open to you. He says, listen, I'm making all of creation, I'm putting everything like a set table in front of you. What I'm going to ask you to do is make choices as moving the switches at the bottom like points for a railway track, or press the switches in a circuit or keyboard. You do that. If you break it, the wires start to jump. Our electrician is in Edgerton at the moment. But if you put too much energy, electricity through a thin wire, what will happen to the actual copper inside the wire? You could start an electrical fire. That's how they start. Something's going wrong in the wiring. And it can melt and it can cause goodness knows terrible damage, right? God just telling you, you now will control the AC voltmeters. I'm putting 613 buttons in front of you. Many of them you won't be able to operate because either you're not a Cohen, you're not a Levi, you're not living at the time of the Beis Hamikdash, you're not a woman, you're not a firstborn boy, whatever it is, each person does their bit, and as a team, Kolisola Ravim Zelazer, as a team, he'll do that, she'll do that, I'll do this, they'll do that, and together we've got all 613 buttons pressed. But the buttons that are with you, which are probably quite minimal, 70, 80 buttons possibly in your life, frankly, that you're really going to be involved with a lot, if the Beis Hamikdash doesn't come, please God, in our days, and then we have to give kabbalahs and stuff like that, please God, it will, but if it doesn't, then we don't have that many buttons which we're likely to press. So the buttons that we are going to press, we've got to make sure that we turn the dials and press the buttons just in the right time, because all the creational system is dependent upon it. Now the truth is, God wanted every single human to be involved in this. And he says, I want to make you the end point of this circuit. I want you to be what the muscles, hair are involved in. I want you to do it. The vast majority of humanity says, I don't want to do it. I'm just not interested. I just want to live my life. I don't want to be involved in that. But if God didn't have a justification to pin that on, there's no point keeping the whole system going. Now, we discussed this. Remember we talked about the idea of challah, which is a little bit. Remember we had the baker here who's quite shocked and he needs the size of a grain of rice, not a whole fistful. Challah. We have the idea of shmitah. We have the idea of Shabbos, where a little bit takes up the whole thing. The omer, the korban omer, one fistful of grain. You're good to go for the whole year and all your grain. Shabbos, one day a week, you're good to go. Shmitah, 1 year, a decade, good to go. Challah, a teeny little bit of the dough. Eretz Yisrael, one little piece of Holy Land, a little bit like that, good to go for all the world, all the land in the world, even to Sacramento, California, all the way there. Plus one planet in the whole universe. One human being, Adam Arishan, to justify that whole thing. God is one. He only needs one person to do one thing once on one day for 1 minute to justify the whole thing. It was man that mucked that up. Later when, that was Adam Arishan, right? Later when all the nations were asked, do you now want to be involved in this tikkun kilkul process? They said, forget it. We're chicken out of this. I don't want to be the pin man. I don't want to do it. I don't want to live like that. For whatever reason. Have to get someone to do it somewhere. Otherwise the entire neuromuscular system will simply not have any justification. There'll be no point. Someone's got to press the buttons. He just asked one person once, Adam Arishan, to do it. And he only asked him to press one button once. He just said, just press one button once. And then you've strengthened that last piece of neurological system because the whole thing is so strong and perfect. I just left one little bit for you. That's the concept of bris milah. Right? One, something that I'm asking you to be involved in perfection. Got a whole thing on bris milah and evolution. In fact, the Jewish men have not evolved not having to have bris milah over 6,000 years. A whole thing about it. It's not for now. So fine. So these, we are the ones that either fix or break everything that we touch. That's how God made the whole system. And that system hinges on free will. You've got to be able to choose whether or not you're going to make a kilkul, a break in the nervous system, a damage to a certain degree. The bigger the mitzvah, the bigger the avera, the bigger the damage or potentially good. The smaller the mitzvah, the smaller the avera, the less damage or potential. That's what makes them bigger or smaller. The good or bad rectification and negativity that actually happens.
We don't know that. We don't know
that's true. We don't. But that's what we talked about, that it's no point knowing that because all of the components are vital.
Yeah.
It's like a circuit board. We don't know that this little resistor is actually very, very cheap, while the processor's really expensive, but at the end of the day, you wouldn't really want to lose your little toe versus your spleen versus your knee versus your heart versus your head. You love them all. No one's willing to just give away their left knee.
And I was saying as well that lack of knowledge or ignorance is not an excuse for someone that wasn't brought up Jewish but is Jewish. It doesn't stand against the fact that they do something wrong but they don't know.
Right, so we're getting a question here from a question saying, what about ignorance? What about ignorance? Can I give you a story that happened to me? Okay. I used to have a car. It was a Rover. A British-made Rover. Not the Japanese engine. The British-made engine. Which, of course, everyone knows is bad already. And something called the Big End went. You know what the big end is? That's bad news. I mean, you can strip it out, get a new engine if you want. The rest of the car was very nice. But it was so expensive to get a new engine, it wasn't worth, it was prohibitive. So I kept the car in the garage. And I got a letter through from the DVLA saying, you haven't taxed your car. So I phoned them up very nonchalantly and said, my car's not on the road. They said, says here it is. I go, says here it is. You can come to my house and look, it's not on the road. Okay, I'll make you a cup of tea. Come over, there's no car on the road. They said, but it's on the road. I said, it's not on the road. Now we're all being spied on by cameras all the time to such an extent. You don't even need to send in a piece of paper. We'll see you driving that car or not. That's where we're at now. We don't even realise that. Okay. But in the old days, a couple of years ago, you had to tell them that my car's not on the road via a statutory off-road SORN notification. SORN. You have to declare SORN and say, my car's not on the road. If your car's not on the road, car's not on the road. But I didn't do that because I didn't know. So I said to the lady, I said, listen, I never heard this concept before. She says, it's on the piece of paper we sent you. It's called SOR. I don't know what that meant. I said, listen, it's really not on the road. Let's just call Bygones and Bygones. And we'll just... For people in the tape world, you're not going to know what this is. Let's call Bygones and Bygones. And let me... I forget this whole tax thing. You know, the beginning's going to... I can show you a piece of paper from a mechanic saying, forget it. She said, you have to pay tax or we're going to fine you. So I said to her, but I didn't know. And she said to me, ignorance is no excuse in the face of the law. It's you have a car, it's your job to know how to tax it. Now let's take this one step further. God has made a neurological system which you live in. I mean, this is real. This is an electron scanning microscope. This is a picture of someone's nerve and muscle. And that system was placed there. Okay? It was placed there one way or another in you. And you live in a system which I'm telling you mystically has the exact same thing happening globally. In fact, the reason it has the exact same thing is because it's like it is and the muscles merely reflect that. You can turn around and say, I don't know. But fucker sure, you can turn around and say, I don't know. There's two problems with saying I don't know. One is when you say I don't know, the truth is it doesn't make the problem go away. You living in the system. So you should know about the system you're living in. Two, if you're saying, I don't know, you're saying, I don't want any input. It's better I don't know and I don't want input. But there is a status where someone doesn't even know they don't know. And that we refer to as a tinuk shenishba, a child that was stolen at birth. And that term was coined when the Romans were leading Jewish children off in galleons from Judea across the Mediterranean Sea to work in houses of prostitution in Rome. And those children were brought up as pagan. Many of those children knew where they were going and they killed themselves by jumping overboard and died Al Kiddush Hashem, and those are the source of kinnis that we read on Tisha B'Av. Those are stolen children. Now, if those children grow up in Rome and they think they're a pagan, I know an individual, a Jewish guy who's grown up a Christian. His dad was a Christian, he took him to church and said, you're a Christian. And he genuinely believes that he's Christian. That's a tinuk shenishba. The Chazon Ish paskind that in Israel, in Tel Aviv, you can't say the people that are walking down the road are tinuk shenishba, the chilonim. Because a suburb of Tel Aviv is Bnei Brak. Walk down the road and you see all these people dressed on Saturday, very soon. Walk on and say, what are you doing? What are you doing? The fact that you've remained ignorant, it's no excuse to the law. If you don't have an opportunity, you genuinely don't have an opportunity. You could have come to a shiur, given it, I don't know, a Jewish philosophy shiur maybe, right? On the outskirts of a large city. And find out about what it means. You're going to be tremendously rewardable for that. Because God wants you to know the system, because now you're going to be plugged into the system. You say, listen, I don't want to know. That's a problem. It isn't this, you can't say, well, I never had an opportunity to know. We live in a generation now where everything has been translated into Russian, French, English, you name it. And the whole of Shas is now available in French. French, in an authoritative translation, right? So we live in a generation where it's harder for us to excuse ourselves saying, I didn't know. You know, everything's in Aramaic and I have no way of cracking into that. And there's people to ask. So why have we got to know? Because we're active players in the system. We've got to be active. That's what God wants. That's what God wanted from Adam. Do something. Either refrain or do something. But you've got to do something. Even being active, even refraining, by the way, is being active. Someone comes up to you and says, please, do you want to eat this non-kosher piece of meat? And you say, no, I don't want to do it. That's being active. And you're active of being unactive. Sheval tasse, you're sitting and not doing. That's a negative. It's an easier one to do. It's a negative precept. Just don't eat it. But you're actively not eating it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Does that answer everything? You got a question? You do have a question. You feel comfortable with that? So we're involved in tikkun or kilkul. I'm halfway down point 7, the second indent from the end of point 7. Page 83. The essence of the state of good, what is good, then, in this term, in nervous system, is when a force, the koyach, the nerve, has the capacity to actually carry the illumination, the electrical impulse of the light, as it were. That light means will. Remember, light in Kabbalistic terminology always means will, of God's presence. He wants Bob the Mallard to go, but unfortunately you shot all the Mallards in the world. You made them extinct. The opposite, therefore, is withheld from a given force when it's bad. The opposite state is that which lacks that capacity. You're damaging the nerve. You're damaging the endpoint. And where this light is therefore withheld from a given force, God can't put that integration, as it were, because you've turned it off. Now, if God wants to play the game, as it were, I don't mean, like when, you know, when Adam Arishan ran behind a tree and God said, where are you? He did that to keep on the level of Adam Arishan's low-level consciousness. Because when a child hides behind something like this and you go, come on, you're hiding behind the bima, come on, find something better. That means the game, he's not playing. But if he hides behind this and he genuinely thinks he's hiding, you go, where are you? So the child thinks he's hiding. He had to do that for Adam now. So if he wants to keep the system going, he has to withhold it. He could push it through, but then he'd break the system. And the system wouldn't work. What would be, okay people, a little bit of chazara. What would be bad about the system not working? Let's get it over to you. If the system doesn't work, that means what? If he says, oh, I've got to make this happen, and I'll just flood the system with energy anyway, forget what mankind's doing, then the system's not justified. You're overruling it. Oh, come on. Now that it's overruled, what's the problem? Lack of free will. Excellent. Is everyone okay with, are you okay with that? If it's a lack of free will, what's the problem with the lack of free will?
It's not the
we're good from God.
That's a very slick two-level up answer. What's the problem with a lack of free will in and of itself? If I lack free will, that means I'll feel what?
Perfection.
I'll feel as if I didn't do anything. Which means if, as I'm saying, God wants to give him his good, you'll feel as if, but I don't really deserve that because I never did that. Which means when God gives that good, it's not a perfect giving. If it's not a perfect giving, he can't give him his good to another because he's perfect. Which means the entire purpose of creation, which is of God giving himself to another, is completely destroyed. Which means he can't do it any other way. He's stuck. He's stuck by the limits of his own perfection. He's bound by the limitations of his own perfection. He can't do it any other way. Gives that. Richard, do you feel comfortable with it?
Yeah, the story that he said about winning the lottery.
Excellent. Yeah. Paul and Natalie winning the lottery, sitting there living life Friday on a check that they never played for. So there's a little bit of a missing thing there. God can't, I could do it. God can't do that. Because if God did that, I'd be like, wow, this is not a perfect giving. If it's not a perfect giving, you've got a problem. Because I feel as if, which means I'm not the master, which means that it wasn't a perfect gift. And that means God didn't give perfectly. And he can't do that because that's a failure. And he can't fail because he's completely devoid of any deficiency. That's what perfect means. I know you have a problem with that. We're in email contact about the problem. We're working through and we're going to get there. But the general concepts, you understand. Yes, you do. Even you do. Now, yes, there's nitty-gritty issues that we have to work. I'm working with you through that. We're going to do that. But most people here, do you see? This whole thing all has to filter down from God created the universe to give of his good to another. We have no idea why he desired to do that. Why can't we know why God chose to do that? We don't know anything about God. Yeah, we do. We know that he's simple.
What he's written down for.
We know that he's simple and perfect. And we all understood that in prophetic revelation at Mount Sinai. Why can't we know why God chose?
In a different dimension.
why can't we know why God chose to create the universe? Why can't we know that?
Because if we knew that, we'd be a god.
No, we couldn't be a god, so we can't know. That's not the answer. The answer is all of our wants are based on needs to a greater or lesser extent. Everything you've ever wanted, you've kind of needed. What God wants, he can't need. Because he doesn't have any needs. So his wants aren't anything like our wants. All of our wants are needs. None of his wants are needs. So if he wanted to do something, you can't say, well, he was bored, he was lonely, he was thinking, gosh, it's either this or Meccano. He can't have a human frailty. So we don't know why he chose to create the universe, but we know he chose to do so and was under no obligation to do it. Because if he was under obligation, then he's not perfect. We'll get to that. Is everyone cool with this all the way so far? And that flows all the way down to this. He has to keep this system going, and he has to let us be on the end of it, and he has to let us either fix it or break it, because if he overrules it in an unjustifiable manner, he destroys the entire system. Sometimes he does overrule the system. Could you give me an example of when he would overrule the system? Oh, Jack. Brains on Jack. Yes, open miracles. But we say every time an open miracle occurred, he made a deal with whatever it was that was going to happen. When the sea of reeds was being created, so I'm only going to allow you to be created on condition that one day you're going to split. So you have to see completely how to acquiesce with that. Which means he's even rigged in open miracles back into the normal system of creation. Because he doesn't want to deviate from that. He doesn't want to deviate from it as much as possible. Any time which he does do an open miracle is always mega justified. As we talked about Abraham being in the furnace of Nimrod, there was not enough merit in Abraham's bank account to save him. There was not enough merit in Isaac's, his unborn son, the Akedah, not enough to save him. They had to look three levels ahead to Yaakov. Basically, Shemana goes, okay, maybe we could... Why? If you're going to do a miracle, just do a miracle already. No, we've got to justify it. To Jonah. Jonah was thrown overboard and a big fish ate him. Why was it a big fish, Jack? Look, so he'd survive. If it's me doing a miracle, right? I'm going to do a miracle. I'm going to make a world and do miracles. I make a sardine eating. When I'm doing miracles, I'm going to go miracle-tastic. I'm going to go like that little sardine comes up and he gets minimized and he's now in the tummy of a sardine. Sardine is swimming around and then he spits him out. And a sardine spits out. Like, could God do that? Could God allow Yonah to be eaten in the tummy of a sardine? Yes, he could. Why didn't he? Sorry? Keep it real. He loves creation the way that he said it. Big things engulf small things. So why should he change that? He keeps it as absolutely naturally ordered all the time as much as he possibly can, even when doing a miracle. Why? This has now got to make sense in our philosophical deep understanding. The system has to keep working, people. We have a nervous system. You're making the nerve bigger than the muscle if you make the sardine eat Yonah. Keep it within the system. He could do that, but you'd be making the system a bit abnormal. He doesn't like that. He likes the idea of spatial dimension, small things fitting into big things. You understand what I'm saying? Does this all make complete sense, people? The result of this rectification of these forces is everything good that exists in the physical world and its converse is the opposite. Every good that happens is because someone has pressed the right button to allow a channel of good nervous impulse down that route. Anything bad that happens is only because someone has pressed the wrong button or pressed the right button wrongly in order to allow a bad influx down that particular channel. It's a system. It's a two-way street. Point 8. It is necessary to realise that the true cause of everything good, whether among the forces or their effects, is the light, the will, as it were, of God's presence. The cause of all evil is the absence of light. Remember my childish idea of the cauldron of water being behind the hot tap? and the Mr. Freeze Ray being behind the cold tap, remember that? I talked about that when I was a child. I tried to understand why is hot water hot and cold water, and these two taps. How does that even work? Where are they coming from? Just two things on the wall and there's hot water go. The absence of heat is cold. The absence of light is dark. Right? The absence of God's presence, the absence of God's will manifest, is evil. A lot of God's will manifest is what we call good. Good is more in line with Shulchan Aruch. Bad is out of line with Shulchan Aruch. If God says, don't eat pigs unless you're in a jungle situation and you need to save your life, generally don't eat pigs. So not eating pigs is in line with Shulchan Aruch. It's a good thing. Eating pigs when you don't need to eat pigs, generally, is an out of line thing and therefore is bad. Not because God's standing behind the stairs going, oh, I just wanted to test you. He's rigged in the system of what eating swine flesh will do to your whole spiritual matrix. And he's telling you to avoid it. Is this making any sense? Please tell me it's making sense. Sense, Richard, sense, yeah. Leslie, sense, get ready. I hope you got highlighters. If you got highlighters, we're going to use the highlight. We're going to need highlighters. If you got them. Now listen to this, this is really important. With regard to good, however, now listen to this, this is so important. This is the difference between heresy and getting it right. Okay? We're playing big stakes poker now. Okay? You could look, you're all in on this one. With regard to good, get this really right. God is considered its actual cause. I didn't eat pork when I was tempted to, because I wanted to do what God wanted from me. God then, as it were, allows the channel, the nervous system, that koach, to flow down to the whole world, not just to me, in a good, good way. What is it that's good about it? His presence correctly manifest. His presence correctly manifest. So with regard to good, however, God is considered the actual cause of good, both in general, the whole flow of the system, and in particular, going down to all the little bits at the bottom. But this is very important to highlight. God is not considered the direct cause of evil. It isn't as if he's doing the bad. What's happening is you're just turning off the heat. If we say a brocha in the morning, I'm on an Arts Consider page, 85. Okay, from the Siddur, we say a brocha just in the very beginning of the Baruch Hu Shema element of Shacharis. We see, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, Lord God, King of the universe. Yotzer Or, who creates light, by his will, Uvara Choshech. And he also creates darkness. Now, what's that going on? Says Rabbi Art Scroll, since the beginning of time, the term light has symbolized new life, wisdom, happiness, and all things associated with good. Darkness, however, is associated with suffering, failure, and death. The philosophers of idolatry claimed that the good God who creates light cannot be the bad one who creates dark. Therefore, they reasoned there must be at least two gods. This is how the Persian system saw this. In modern times, the same argument is presented in different terms. How can there be a God if he allows bad things to happen? For somehow the Holocaust happens means that God must disappear in a puff of logic. That's their argument. The blessing refutes the argument that anything people find unpleasant either is not an act of God or proves that he lacks power. To the contrary, we believe unequivocally that God is one. What appears to our limited human intelligence to be the contradictory or evil reality is in part a plan of God. What does this mean? He creates light and dark. He creates the possibility of light and dark. Light is I do a good thing so the whole system is lit up. If I do a bad thing or something bad comes in, his withholding of that light is what we call dark. There's not another force that's coming along, a cold ray. That's a childish concept, right? There's a Mr. Freeze. Remember I thought there was Mr. Freeze with a gun going, and blue lightning would come out and freeze the water, and then I would turn the tap and it would be cold. But really, you know, all water is basically room temperature. That's ridiculous. It's a lack of heat that's causing the cold. The lack of light is what's causing evil. A lack of in line with godness is what's evil. So God is, as it were, he's the indirect cause of evil, but not the direct cause of evil. Evil is the gap. I've got to tell you this amazing idea I had from Rabbi Binyamin Moshkovitz of Medrash Shmuel in Jerusalem. He's a Rosh Hashiva of Medrash Shmuel, Yeshiva in Jerusalem. He has an incredible idea. How come when someone's alive, you can shake their hand, you don't need to wash your hand afterwards? But if you go see someone when they're dead, at a grave, when you leave, you should lave your hands because of a level of impurity. This, you can use this analogy in loads of places. Let me give it to you. It's a very useful analogy. If you want to trap wasps or bees, there's two ways of doing it. You take a jar of honey, completely full, open up the lid and leave it out on a hot day. You get about 4 or 5 bees in the top of the honey. Take a jar of honey and empty the whole thing out. Then put it out and leave it there for an hour. Be full of bees or wasps. Full. The jar in this analogy is the human body, and the honey is the soul. While the soul is associated with a guf, the genetically encoded receptacle of the higher elements of the soul, the forces of negativity find it very difficult to attach to the body because they're basically pushed away by the power and the brilliance of the neshama. But when the neshama leaves the body, it generally doesn't leave cleanly. Yaakov Avinu took off his body like we would take off our coats. It says when the righteous die, it's like removing a hair from milk. But when the wicked die, it's like pulling a thorn from wool, or a bushel, like a thistle from wool. Whenever we do an Aveira, a sin, part of our soul, which is associated with that organ that the Aveira has been done with, clings to the body. So that at death, the body and soul don't part cleanly. So you get bits of spirituality and snippets stuck around different organs of the body. That's like pouring the honey out of the jar. That is extremely attractive to forces of negativity. So it becomes, and it's accessible to them. They can get hold of it. They won't drown in the honey. There's just a little film of honey around the edge of the inside of the jar, and that they can hop. So the darkness is because of a lack of the honey being there. They can only get in because the honey's not there. It's because of the lack of the potency of the good. There's no void anywhere in creation. It's what we call in science an antagonistic relationship. We have a sort of bicep, tricep. Bicep, tricep. Top of the arm is a bicep, bottom of the arm is a tricep. So far, so good? Yeah, does everyone agree with that? No, it's a banana and an apple, and we all know that. So it's a bicep and a tricep. Now, when my bicep squeezes in, when it contracts, my tricep has to go floppy. And when my tricep of the bottom arm contracts, my bicep has to go floppy. When one's tight, the other's got to be loose. Because if they're both tight, I'd get a rigor mortis. And if they're both loose, I won't be able to move my arm. Is that true? Does that make sense to everyone? It's called an antagonistic relationship. When one's on, one's off. One's on, off. This is tight, it's got to be loose. Tight, loose. That's how I move my arm. By the tightening or loosening one of the other side. Light and dark are in an antagonistic relationship. When you don't have light, that gap is always filled up by dark. When you put more light in, it's always pushing more dark out. It's almost like a siphon or a syringe with a glass and you're pulling out or pushing in. Either it's got good in or it's got evil in. It's never empty. There's no vacuum in creation. God's filled up everything in creation, either with light or the stuff that fills up the gap, which we call darkness. So darkness is a real thing. It's a created thing, which is designed. You know, a lot of the universe is dark matter. It's just stuff because nothing's empty. We used to think in between universes there was nothing. Now we know it's full of stuff. We just don't know what it is. All of the universe is like this. God is the cause of good because it's him coming through, but he's not the direct cause of evil. It's his not being there that causes the evil, that him not being there, by the amount of him not being there, is what we call evil. That's highlighted. So the highlight is God is considered the actual cause of good, but God is not considered the direct cause of evil. It isn't as if you do something wrong, then he comes along with a lightning bolt, and mummy tries to go like that and hurt you. It's not like that. He's not the bogeyman under the stairs. He's not just trying to get you. He's not the direct cause of evil. On the other hand, And we are thus taught that God does not relate his name to evil. Highlight. God is nevertheless still the indirect cause even of evil, since its actual cause is either the absence of good. Sorry, it's since its actual cause is the absence of good, and it therefore results from the absence of God's light and the concealment of his presence. That's basically what I said very, very, very tightly. It isn't as if God is making the evil. God's lack of his presence in the world is what we call evil. So you could say, well, that's kind of down to him at the end, because he's not there. But not that he's actually the evil bit. Cold is a lack of heat. Rishus, or ra, evil, is a lack of absence of Hashem in a particular situation. Does that make sense? That's the rule. Are you sense? Are you making sense? Comfortable? Let's continue. No bounds or limits can be placed on God's omnipotence. And therefore, there's nothing preventing him, should he so want, from creating even evil actual stuff if he so desired. In order for the various concepts of evil to exist, though, he created a particular root and source in the koichos, in the nervous system, for this. The purpose of the source of evil, somewhere in the koichos, somewhere in the brain of creation, was to give rise to particular concepts so that both man and the world be in a desired state of balance between the two, to have a contrast, right and wrong. Regarding this source of evil, scripture states, God forms light and creates darkness, makes peace and creates evil. He's striking a balance for you to exist in so that you can make a choice with your, basically, the fulcrum point of that balance. This source of evil in the archetype of the Koichos includes many different forces, a whole spinal column, as it were, of evil, from which all concepts of deficiency and evil originate. Anything bad is somehow linked into this program. It can affect both body and soul in their varying categories. And we'll discuss this much further, I would add, in the second section, where we talk about what does and what doesn't work. But in general, the activity of these evil forces, both individually and as a whole, depend on the extent to which God's light is absent and his presence concealed. I've written down a little note to give you an analogy. It's amazing, this. You don't have to have a lot of evil to make things a bit bad. It's a pretty gross example. Do you mind if I go with you in this example? I once went to Rosh Hashiva of Mendel Weinbach and I asked him a question on something and he didn't give me an answer. He gave me this analogy. He didn't give me an answer. He said, here's an analogy and you go figure out the answer. Fascinating, fascinating response he gave me. He said to me like this. He used to call me Mitchell. That's great. Mitchell. Anyway, you can't do that. Don't do that. It's not fair. My wife even doesn't do that. Only the Rosh Hashiva could call me that. He said to me like this. Let's say you bake the most beautiful chocolate cake. Like the best sucker taut sponge. Properly soaked in liqueur. And then, you know, you cut it up and you put layers of the finest chocolate cream. So you're going to make a layer cake. Okay? Layer cake. You're going to have sponge, chocolate. Now he says, in the middle layer of that cake, you're not going to put chocolate. You're going to take a baby's nappy, which is full, and you're going to empty the contents of that nappy on the middle layer of that cake. Looks the same, right? Smear it in. Then you go on with another perfect cake. I'm talking 5-star, Alec. Perfect cake, then chocolate, that. Then you take the whole thing, then you ice it, and you put the S's on, you know, on each piece. You put like an S with a cherry on it. Mamish perfect! Then you cut it up and you serve it. You have a mamish perfect chocolate cake, except for that middle layer. That middle layer, not so good. You're served a slice of that cake. The hotel is going to get a letter from me. Do you know what was in this cake? Corruption. You get a slice of that cake. Now the kasha is, Do you eat the cake? Would you eat that slice of cake? Absolutely echoed. Is it? But hold on! 99.9% of that slice is the best cake in the world! Made by Swiss chefs who have total precision with chocolate! I walked around in Switzerland and I was cashing a hotel in Switzerland and they had chocolate managed like shops where they're making chocolate there. The chefs whisking chocolate in the window, pouring it into molds, talking the best chocolate, apart from the nappy in the middle. Would you sit and spoon out all the good chocolate and just leave like a bit of sponge on either side because you really want such a good piece of cake, it's a shame to waste it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, this is a really good cake with a cherry on top. Well, the cherry's not a fake, isn't it? And the S, I'll take the S. Would you do that? Absolutely no way! Not a chance! You go, yeah, I don't care how good it is, it's not good. When you have a Torah idea, when you're doing a corruption in it, corrupts it totally. A little bit of corruption ruins it. Even though you could say 99.9% is good. Sometimes new political movements come about in Judaism, which are seemingly based on Torah. And there's a lot of Torah in those movements. But there's something in them which isn't right. That's the nappy layer in the cake. Unless it's unadulterated, completely pure, it ain't Torah. It's got to be absolutely pristine, or it doesn't work. You'd reject it in your life anyway. So too with these forces. If you have a force coming in that's good, and then there's a trickle of evil in it, it can muck up a lot of the good that you get. Like an apple with a worm in. Have you ever bitten into an apple that has a worm in? Have you done that? I did that, and you just, that is like the most disgusting. It's when you have half a worm, that's right. When you bite into an apple with half a worm in, that's horrendous, right? But the point is, the whole apple is ruined, even though only an element is truly ruined. You could truthfully cut that off and carry on. The whole thing is repugnant in the extreme. These evil forces, once they get involved, they tend to be very potent in their repulsion of good. That's why we have to be so careful when doing a mitzvah that we get it right and that our intentions are at least as egotistically removed as possible. Although we learn out that being egotistically involved in the beginning is probably good long term, because even though you're doing lolishmo now, you're not doing it for the sake of doing the mitzvah. Eventually this will train you in the way of mitzvahs. We see it as a progressive state that hopefully will weed out, you know, the evil, the nappy layer over a period of time. In and of itself, it's a corruption. We're looking at least do a little well than a lot with nappy in the layer. There may be 20 cakes that are very good, but they've got nappy. There may be one small cake that's edible. It's quality over quantity on that one. Are you with me on that concept? Does that make sense? That's my chocolate cake with layer in that I've got my note on. When these evil forces, when the nappy layer gains power and authority, the force of good is weakened. The cake itself is no longer desirable. And those forces, which are the roots of all created things, are damaged. You can write in the word kilkel. That's the kink. The damage is going all the way up to the nervous system. The Malachim, remember, are just train carriages, and they're going to get knocked off points. This in turn weakens both the forces and their derivative branches all the way down, which are the physical things associated with them. Trees are the outcome of the forces to do with trees. So all trees are being ruined by the evil in this force. Because you see, that's what happens when you play at the top. If you start mucking around at the cistern end, then everything that comes out of all the taps is ruined. That's what happens if you start mucking around with the plumbing that far up. If we do mitzvahs very incorrectly, that's how all of justification is either sullied or corrected. That's how it works. When it says, oh, you know, you, the next thing you're going to do is going to fix the world. The next thing you're going to do is going to damage the world. What does that mean? This is what it means. The next thing you're going to do is either going to strengthen or damage the kaichas, because the kaichas are delicate and waiting for your input. When the forces of evil are subjected, though, right, they're subjugated and deprived of their authority to act, you nullify them, on the other hand, then good becomes strengthened. The roots of all created things are then rectified, tikkun, and are set in a good state so that both they and their branches are strengthened. Does anyone have a neighbour who has a child who plays football? Do you have a neighbour whose child plays football? Okay. This is really good for Yom Kippur.
We have a child who plays football.
Do you have a child who plays football? Anyway, we don't need a neighbour. We have a child that does that. I want to give you a beautiful analogy for Yom Kippur, for Rosh Hashanah, for all year round. This is a great analogy. You have a problem neighbour who has an 8-year-old boy who likes to play football and kicks the football regularly through your kitchen window. Regularly. Like, it's not 3, it's not 4, it's like a lot. Okay? There you are, sitting down, having your breakfast, let's say with your spouse, just eating your coffee. Suddenly, pshing! Boink, 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 boink. Football comes straight through your kitchen window again. Oh, that's the 7th time. That is the last time he does it. So you're going to take the football, you're going to stab it up and stuff like that, you're going to take it out. You know what's going to happen, and then suddenly, knock on the door, usually it's Timmy asking for his ball back, right? She's going to go on Google and give him a straight in his face. She's running to the front door. You open the front door, and what do you see? The most decrepit state. A little 8-year-old boy, one shoe, all the laces undone, sock down his ankle. Standing there. Tears, and he's got a little bubble of snot forming out of one nostril. The whole thing, you go, all right, Timmy, all right, now please don't ever do it again. I won't ever play football, I'll completely forget the cold content of ball games forever, blah, blah. You give him the ball and go, all right. Come back in, you sit down. Your spouse turns around, she goes, what happened? He goes, I gave him the ball back. You softy, what happened? Oh, he was so sad. He was so sad. I just forgave him. When you forgave him, that means he's no longer culpable for the crime. Okay. What's that called in Hebrew? If the boy that does that, the boy has done
teshuva.
He's repented. He is so utterly devastated that he simply couldn't do that act again. That's called teshuva. I've got news for you. You're sitting there in the draft. Your window's still broken. Teshuva didn't fix that. Teshuva meant, I'm not going to build Timmy. Timmy is scot-free. I'm sitting there, and I've got news for you. I've got to call Mr. Glassman, and he's going to come round, and he's going to charge me. I'm going to have to put a new piece of glass in. And Timmy ain't going to do it. What should Timmy really do? Timmy should go, do all that. Get to Shiva. And they say, I don't know what you're going to do. Comes in with a big pain. good evening there. Nice to see you. Oh, it's actually morning because you're having breakfast, but... He's got tools and he's got a little paddle, pulls out the sides, putty, the whole thing. He cleans out the glass, puts all the kylie in a bucket, puts the glass back, puts little things in the side, because it goes, that's good, go with some glass, cleans it all, goes, look, it's as good as new. That is called tikkun. That's called repair or fixing. Without the base of Mikdash, we can only do teshuva. I.e. we could remove culpability of the damage of our sins that we've done from us. But we have smashed a lot of windows and a lot of kaichas. The korbanos were the fixing agents. When you do an aveira, let's say a physical aveira, you flip on a light switch on Shabbos. By accident, not on purpose. There's no korban for any aveira ever done on purpose. No korbanos for that. Can't fix it. I'll tell you for why. This is the Al-Shech HaKadosh. Rabbi Moshe Al-Shech says this. My body was involved in doing this. Why should I even go? It was an accident. Whoops, it was an accident. I just turned off the lights. Ooh! Why is that even a sin at all? It was accidental. The answer is, had I been sufficiently aware it was Shabbos, I would never let my body do that. Never let my body do that. You go to High Court, where, you know, you go to the High Court in, you know, in London, where the judge is wearing a very long, long wig. And the barrister's there, and you get up, what are you doing? Oh, couldn't control myself. I just love that song. They're like, Meshuggahna. There's a certain thing. If you realise where you are, you aren't going to make that kind of mistake. That Avera is cured by one, doing tshuva, being careful what you touch on Shabbos, and two, bringing a korban chatas, a sin offering, in the temple. The fire that consumes the korban spiritually consumes the malachim that were created by that negative act. So the malachim, remember, are the bad train carriages going up the koyach, which would respond, which would be the messenger, which would make a bad thing happen in the koyach, which would create the whole negative system in the nervous system. I'm going to kill them. I have to kill them. I have to nullify that spiritual end, that spiritual force. The fires of the base of English did that. Why can't you give a korban for an avera that was done on purpose? Because if the soul and the body were both involved in the doing of an avera, the malachim that would be created would be so strong that even the fires on the altar in the temple couldn't kill them. School doesn't bother you to do it. It's useless. It's too strong. That's just dangerous. And that's sending negativity up, which makes negativity come down. Yom Kippur means I'm really, so God says, right, I'm hereby voiding you, like, I'm cleaning the slate that you have to pay, but the damage is still happening. That's why we sit on the floor for Tisha B'Av. What are we mourning the loss of? We're mourning the loss of the fixing ability of Timmy to come in and put a new pane of glass in. Then he started us like it never happened. But this is not like it never happened. Tshuva's been done by Timmy, but he hasn't done a tikkun. This is talking of tikkun versus kilkul. Fixing versus damage. So we're talking about the real deal stuff here. Not the fact I'm not culpable. That's half the picture. It's half the picture. He says everything therefore depends on the strengthening of these forces via tikkun, whether it be the concepts of good or evil. Good coming into the world being strengthened, good. Bad coming to the world is a lack of good. The battle between the physical and the spiritual. My stomach wanting pork versus God saying it's not a good idea. God saying it's not a good idea, don't do it. Or other matters of perfection and deficiency. When either the force of good or that of evil gains the power, the upper hand, based upon man's indeterminate influences, its qualities and effects of course and influence all created things. Squid, peanut butter, lemonade. It says the air from Jerusalem went to Switzerland. The water went to France. There's no pleasure in the world outside of bathing since the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Walking down the road was a tremendously pleasurable experience. When I go to Israel, I taste cucumbers and tomatoes. They taste so much more like cucumbers and tomatoes than the ones in England. You don't understand the pleasure we've lost. The whole force is all that's coming down. All of it's been nullified to a certain extent. It's been damaged. When either one is subjugated, on the other hand, good or evil, its activity is nullified and its attributes and effects are removed from the roots and branches of creation. You can fix it. This is what we call a fluid dynamic. It's an equilibrium. It's a system set up to be in balance, either in bad or good, based upon how the system's being affected. There are many levels among the qualities of these evil forces and what results in them. I've highlighted now, if you have a highlight or underline, this whole bit until the end of this indent. In general, their effects are called corruption, which you may have heard of as the word tumah, darkness, chayshach, pollution, zahama, mundane, chol, and the like. Now, those are different levels. Chol is just mundane. It's already not great, but it's not that bad. All the way up to zahama and tumah, which are bad. Highlight. Things resulting from the illumination of God's presence, on the other hand, are called Kedusha, holiness, Tahara, purity, Ora, light, Bracha, blessing, and the like. Let's just contrast this to page 175. Jump ahead to page 175. Can you see? Look at the top of the page. The cause of all this, however, can you see? Top of page 175. The cause of all this, however, is God's influence. It is as a direct result of this influence that that man gains every quality and characteristic, both in general and particular. Highlight, if you can. The source of all such things is either the light of God's presence or its absence. That's, we could have read that right about our paragraph, right? Jump down to the next indent. The influence of God's illumination thus results in such qualities as advantage, ribawi, clarity, zakus, and value, yakar. The concealment of his light, on the other hand, brings about disadvantages such as chisarum, opaqueness, avus, and worthlessness, shiftless. And I've written there contrast with page 87. It's all the same idea running through the whole sefer. More good in the world means more good and different types of good. More bad in the world is different types of bad. Back on page 87. Second to last indent on the page. These are all the general categories. Like general damage, good, rectification, sickness, health. When we consider their elements, however, we're able to distinguish the specific categories and details of these general classes. Around these revolves all of God's providence, organizing the system of how he made one thing do another, through which he directs his world. For each of these concepts, however, very important, there are agents or overseers, impulses, you could write in, belonging to the general class of angels. I've highlighted, appointed to translate, stroke, transduce, from the CD to the speaker, them into action in the physical world. These agents, malachim, are influences, impulses, appointed to translate these concepts into action in the physical world. They are the electric impulse flowing down the nerve to make action happen in a muscle. That's how we live. This is how the whole system, we live in this system, we breathe in this system. This is true of both good concepts and their opposite. The angel, look, whatever you, I went to I took a tour to Auschwitz. I remember asking the tour guide a question. He didn't have an answer for me. He was a brilliant tour guide. He knew so much about history. We saw one of the trains which took our brethren into the death camps. And I noticed that the trains were armoured. When I mean armoured, I mean like a Securicore armouring, plates of bulletproof steel welded onto the sides of the locomotive. So you couldn't shoot through to the boiler tank to stop the... So I said, why are these trains armoured? He didn't have an answer. 2 years later, I figured it out. IBM organized the trains as well. They helped with the computer system that organized the delegation of movement all the way from Corfu and France all the way into the center of Poland for the death of the Jews. And they had to get a lot of whole train system across all of Europe. So it was Jews into the death camps. But what came out, people? What came out the death camps? Jews in, and the trains left, right? To get more Jews. But they didn't leave empty. They were full. What were they full of?
Possession.
Money! Tons and tons of Jewish artifacts stolen and shipped across Europe, mainly to Switzerland. They were armoured because they were money trucks. They didn't want to get them robbed after they had robbed it. So they'd killed the Jews, pulled out the gold from their teeth, taken all their money, put them on the trains, then organised a whole logistical system to go to depositories. There were German guards now that had been found in Germany and across Europe that were involved in the money counting operation of the Waffen-SS. There were guards specifically set aside in order to calculate and logistically account for all this money, which was then shipped to Switzerland who of course were neutral. Money in, Jews. The angels are the trains! They don't go back empty! They come down doing something, you load them! And we talked about Ruth lighting the Shabbos candles. What's happening when she does that? We say, Zaitzchem l'shalom. May you go to peace. Say, Baruchem l'shalom. Come in peace. You've got a changing of the guard. The Melachim now of the week are saying, we're done. We're done this week. Now they go back up. Load it with whatever you've loaded them with. Zaitzchem l'shalom. Go to peace. I've made you. I've loaded you. They're like just train carts. You put in your spirituality on them. They're okay. We're off. There you go. We say, you know, have a good journey. That's it. I'm never going to see you again. That's this week. Finished. Forever in creation. That week is never going to happen in 5775, 5776, etc. That's never going to happen again. You load the train carriages. How you load them changes the universe. The universal flow. Your flow. Destiny. Everything. It's all based on you. Of course it's based on you because God's made a conversation, as it were, between him and you. The only important points in this whole system is the outcome. When I was picking up that pen, the only important point is my will picking up the pen and the pen. Don't tell me, oh, the nerves, the patella and the cartilage and your musculature and the endocrine system. Yes, they were all facilitators. But the real thing was I wanted to pick something up. So the thing that I want to pick up and me are the two important things here. That my fingers, the fingernail, and the blood supply, the capillaries and everything like that. You're not focusing on that. You're focusing on that? Crazy, who cares? But that's a science in its own world. People go to school for 3, 4, 5, 6 years just to learn how you do that. But it's not what's chashuv. What chashuv is, doing it. Which is why everyone's always harping about doing mitzvahs. You go to a shoe, oh, this kind of shoe, that kind of shoe, that kind of shoe, there. But what's always the bottom line? Absolute, the money on the line. What's the money? What's the money in the... Why? Because you're loading the trains. It's down to you. That's how the system was built. It's all on you. You have no option. That's how the system... You live in it. You can't escape it. The train's going to turn up. It's either going to go full of bad, or it's going to go full of good. Or a mixture of both, more likely. You can't change the system. God's authority cannot be overruled. Shabbos is going to happen 7 days later than the previous Shabbos. You can't affect that. Yom Kippur will occur. The question is, how are you going to be when it happens? Are you going to be there or not? How are you going to load those carriages? It's all down to you. God has left you in the most remarkably authoritative and honourable position of you doing it. Our greatest time is living here on this earth. Before you come to this earth, you have no input. You can't even choose which mother you're gestated in. Not your choice. And where in time you'll be placed. After you leave the earth, you've got nothing to do but worry about just what it is you did while you were on the earth. And praise the Kodesh Baruch Hu if you did well. You have nothing to do. Now, us in this world, full of filth and dirt and all this business, are at the highest possible point of our entire existence ever in our lives. Because we can do stuff. We're almost like God in that respect. He's leaving it over to you. So that he can justifiably give of his good to you for doing it. This all makes one perfect idea. Like a pill. One idea. Thus concludes the first section of 4 of the quintessential book of Jewish philosophy. It takes you from the concept that there is a God who is constantly involved. He has to be constantly involved because he only lives in the present. We live in the past, right? We don't live in the future. We don't live in the present. He lives all now, which means Adam's making the mistake now and I'm taking my driving test now. It's all happening now, right now. So it's all one instant. There's no time. Of course he's got to be constantly involved because there's no time. So there's only constants that are left. And he wants, for reasons that we cannot fathom, to give of his good to something separate from himself. Not because he needs to, because he wants to. Now that he's desired to do that, he has to make the most incredibly complicated, convoluted system to allow us to exist on a lower level so that we can honestly believe that his will is no more important than a pork sandwich and choose to accept. These, by the way, these 10 up here, they're not suggestions. They're not really good bits of idea that you could think about over tea. Why don't you think about these? These are points for discussion in a home group. That's not what they are. They're commandments. Do this or don't do this. If you do them, you are in compliance. If you don't do them, you're criminal. That's what we're playing for here. And he said, this is what I've told you to do. Because the trucks are coming in anyway. That's the system I put you in. Once you load the trucks correctly, you are fully justified in reaping the real currency, which is closeness to the infinite creator, which cannot be in this world now because of Adam Arishan's, okay? It has to be manufactured in a zone which can hold that, which you call Olam Haba, as we discussed in the beginning of the first section. That's all he wants. All he wants is Olam Haba. All he wants is to give of his good to another. He just has to justify it. Why does he have to justify it? Because if he didn't, it wouldn't be a perfect giving. And he's got to give it perfectly. So there's no other way. It's just that simple, folks. You've put, for those of you that have been here since the beginning, you've put in way over 25, 30 hours of work to make it all that simple. And that's, remember my barber, what's it all about? Cutting my hair, what's it all about? Why are we here, what's it all about? Well, that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. One sentence. To justifiably earn closeness to the Creator. That's what it's all about. Next time, what we're going to do is lift the bonnet of the car and actually start naming anatomical features of the engine. Now, I have to say, I find that particularly challenging. Other people say they find two really easy and three really hard. I find three fun. Section three is just a blast. I love three. But two is, how actually does this work? Why do we need a judgmental process? Why? What's going on? Really, what's really going on when we start talking about this? That's section two. What we've talked about now is the general gross concepts. What we're going to start doing is dissecting in cross-section each of these zones, saying, right, all right, what's going on in there? Why must it be like that? Why must the train track have sleepers? Why must trains have wheels? Why? Why not make them hover on something else? That's section two. And that gives you the depth of understanding. When someone turns around and goes, why did this have to happen? We can't know exactly in each specific case, but we can definitely say the generalities. It has been truly, truly an honour and a pleasure to get to the first quarter of this Sefer with you. It's really awesome. And really, the whole Sefer was summed up in that last sentence. Right? Please God, we'll continue. Anon, it's been really a pleasure. Thank you so, so much for listening to it all. See you again.